When the police raided the Stonewall Inn back in 1969, they had no idea that it would eventually lead to the birth of gay pride.
We started standing up for ourselves and said, this is who we are and you're going to accept us.
I'm Mark Fennell and I am the host of the ABC Radio National podcast, No One Saw It Coming. Each week, we unravel a moment in history that changed the course of the world, but, well, no one saw it coming. To hear it, search for No One Saw It Coming on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Today on Rear Vision, China in the Western Hemisphere. President Trump wants the United States to once again assert its economic and political dominance over the Western Hemisphere, including the Caribbean and Latin America.
We sort of forgot about it. It was very important, but we forgot about it. We don't forget about it anymore. Under our new national security strategy, American dominance in the Western Hemisphere will never be questioned again. Won't happen.
At its core, it says the United States must be preeminent in the Americas to protect its security and prosperity.
But for the last 10 years, China has been dominant in Latin America.
Having collaborated for a decade now, China wanted to mark the anniversary with a big vision.
By joining hands together, China and Latin America can create a super large market of over 2 billion people, which will both offer an engine for respective growth and also open up new opportunities for global prosperity.
Since the turn of the 21st century, trade between China and Latin America has increased 40-fold. Today, China is the number one trading partner of South America. So, how realistic are US plans to reassert its influence? Could we be heading toward a superpower clash in the Americas? Today on Rear Vision, with me, Ros Bluett, the battle for the dominance and dividends of Latin America. The influence of the Chinese in Latin America is not new. It goes back centuries. The nation of Peru, located on the west coast of South America, just above Chile and just below Ecuador, is a case in point. If you've ever been there, you'd know about Chifa. There are over 6,000 Chifa restaurants in Peru's capital, Lima, alone. It's a fusion of Chinese and Peruvian cuisine, and it's been around a long time. The surge in China's connection with Latin America took off at the start of the 21st century, but links between the two began way before then, with wooden barrel-shaped trading ships known as Manila Galleons.
Those links go back all the way to the 16th century.
Jorge Heiner is non-resident fellow at the Quincy Institute in Washington, D.C.
In 1565, the Manila Galleon started crossing the Pacific Ocean, bringing goods, mostly from China, brought all the way to Acapulco in Mexico, and from then on to other parts of Latin America and to Spain itself. The Manila Galleon operated for 250 years. Every year, a huge ship would take to Latin America manufactured goods, silks, China wares, and would bring back mostly silver. So there's really a very deep history there. This was the first modern globalization process that took place, that connected China and Latin America.
What you might call the first really truly globalized economic circuit, which really lasts for the best part of 250, 300 years up to the early 19th century, the Napoleonic period.
Rana Mitter is S.T. Lee Chair in U.S.-Asia Relations at the Harvard Kennedy School.
So that trans-Pacific trading, very much linked to Spanish Empire, is one of the most long-lasting manifestations of that connection in terms of global trade in the early modern era, in which silver from South America, luxury goods from China, and European trading, entrepreneurship, colonialism, and consumer demand all come together.
A couple of decades after the Manila Galleons cease, around 1840, another fleet of ships set sail from China.
You get a mass migration of Chinese workers to South America. Why on earth to South America, particularly to Peru and actually to Cuba as well? So actually South America, Central America, I should say, Latin America. Why? Because if you look at those dates, that's the same time when slavery begins to be abolished. The bringing in of large numbers of Chinese workers who are not enslaved, but under pretty terrible conditions, indenture and other forms of what you might call unfree labor. They're not free simply to barter their labor. They come in very large numbers or significant numbers. And they were involved in an awful lot of different types of industry, plantations, guano mines, building railroads, a lot of jobs that involved a lot of very backbreaking labor.
Including the construction of the Panama Canal in the early 20th century and the first chifa restaurants. But despite this influx of Chinese workers and restaurants, China's diplomatic relationship with the Western Hemisphere was minimal. Post-World War II, fear of communism gripped the West, and it only began to thaw with President Nixon's visit in 1972. Professor of Latin American Studies with the US Army War College, Evan Ellis, says Mao Zedong's 1949 People's Republic of China was not universally acknowledged by Latin America.
When in 1949 the communists took over, there were very few countries in Latin America that actually recognized China. You had Cuba after its communist revolution. You had in Chile, Salvador Allende, when he came to power briefly. What was interesting, though, was during the Mao period and the Cultural Revolution, so, you know, 1966 to 1976, what you had was China embracing the Third World Movement, the Non-Aligned Movement. But really, until the 1970s, there was very little political relationship. I would say that the beginnings of that relationship traces back to Deng Xiaoping's opening in 1978. You have this flowering in the 70s and 80s, where countries start up relations, but China is largely closed economically.
Nixon, Kissinger, all these, you know, sorts of politicians were actually very interested in keeping South America anti-communist and pro-American, so much so that essentially supporting pretty brutal governments in Argentina and Chile in particular, but other places too, became a core part of US policy. So you could argue that in some senses, the policy has adapted, but not really changed all that much.
During the 1980s, Deng Xiaoping's economic reforms and opening up of China's economy started bearing fruit. Not yet a member of the World Trade Organization, China upped its bilateral trade deals. Globalization becoming the buzzword of the 1990s.
The high point of globalization was probably actually the Clinton administration, and by the early 2000s, more and more voters, and therefore more and more politicians, became skeptical about whether or not globalization was really creating benefits for American voters. As the US turned more and more against trade deals, it became harder and harder to sign any proper free trade deals with the US. At the same time, it became easier to sign them with China. Why is that? What changed? Well, first of all, China got richer. And that meant that it wanted to build and develop a lot more, and it also wanted to, you know, feed people better. It also, of course, became a market as South America became richer, middle classes in Chile, Brazil, Argentina want to buy things. Where do they import things from? Well, the same place that everyone else in the world does, manufacturers in China.
And the cherry on the top for China was that in 2001, it was finally admitted to the World Trade Organization. Professor Wang Wen from the School of Global Leadership at Beijing's Renmin University says that being a member of the WTO opened up trade opportunities for China, especially in Latin America.
The tariff is very, very low, and China imports many products from Latin America because of a low tariff. So this is a very important turning point. China needs energy and agricultural products from Latin America, rare materials and energy resources to China. Whatever China needs, Latin America can provide.
There is a remarkable complementarity between the Chinese economy and the South American economies. China has 19% of the world's population, but it only has 7% of the world's freshwater reserves and only 7% of the world's agricultural land. What does this mean? It means that China cannot feed itself. It will always depend on importing vast amounts of food. In South America, those equations are exactly the opposite. South America is an underpopulated part of the world. It has about one quarter of all the world's freshwater reserves. It has some of the best land in the world, the Pampa Húmeda in Argentina. So what does this mean? Right now, about a quarter of all the agricultural goods that China imports come from four countries in South America: Brazil, Uruguay, Argentina, and Chile.
Recognizing China's growing success in Latin America, the Chinese leadership drew up their 10th five-year plan in 2001.
There was a recognition that as China was becoming more and more globally engaged, there was increasingly a willingness and need to create a world that was what I would call safe for the rise of China. The 10th five-year plan, you had a blessing of what was called the go-out policy, telling Chinese companies, you need to, you know, increase these relations in terms of access to extra hemispheric supply, led largely by the Chinese SOEs, Chinese state-owned enterprises, and increasingly saw people-to-people engagement, reaching out more to party leaders and things like that, and the beginnings of security cooperation, some military gifts and things like that. But it was really, in my judgment, about, number one, trying to make a world that was, you know, safe for the good treatment of Chinese companies and that politically would not resist access to them. For me, it was not that the PLA, the People's Liberation Army, had a master plot of, you know, driving Chinese businesses, but it was more the other way around, that as Chinese businesses built these relationships, the Chinese government saw these opportunities and thus supported these in strategic areas. During the Bush administration, the Assistant Secretary of State for Latin American Affairs, Roger Noriega, I remember talking to him, actually had testified from a Republican standpoint that he didn't see China as a big deal. But at the time, I think the U.S. trade with Latin America was 12 times that of China, and Chinese investment was almost minimal in the region.
Former Chilean ambassador to China, Jorge Heine, agrees this period of the early 2000s was more about cooperation than conflict.
In the first decade of this century, the U.S. State Department Western Hemisphere Division, they would meet with the counterparts of the, you know, the Latin American division of the Chinese Foreign Ministry. And they would meet yearly, and they did this for a number of years, from, I don't know, 2006 till 2014 or so. And they would discuss their common interest in how they could work in Latin America to boost growth in the region and to make the region more developed. This sounds very outlandish today, but this in fact happened.
But then under Democratic administrations, you saw Assistant Secretaries of State like Arturo Valenzuela, later Roberta Jacobson, who were increasingly nervous. But there was a sense that even though China is a competitor, these are economic interactions, and the principles of the U.S. are not to try to block, you know, sovereign states from engaging in what seemed to be mostly economic relations, although there were expressions of concern.
But the concern didn't trigger a renewal of U.S. investment in Latin America. Professor Wang Wen thinks the U.S.'s attitude was outdated and paternalistic.
American government identified Latin America as their backyard. Latin America just like the little brother, their colony, something like that. So they didn't invest enough in Latin America. They didn't treat Latin America equally. So that's why, but now China has come. China provides the real and pragmatic interest to the Latin American. And also China help Latin American development.
What we have seen in the course of this century is growing disinterest of the United States, particularly in South America, in which U.S. companies have been disinvesting, have been withdrawing. And in parallel, we have had, of course, the growth of Chinese companies that have come in. A Chinese company, BYD, which makes electric vehicles, moved into the state of Bahia in Brazil, taking the facilities of the Ford Motor Company, taking over the factory of Mercedes-Benz. As U.S. companies and European companies leave South America, Chinese companies move in.
You're listening to Rear Vision on Radio National. I'm Ros Bluett. And today we're looking at China's relationship with Latin America. One of the main areas where China's leading the way in South America is in infrastructure, not only in high tech, but building railways, highways, subways and ports. In fact, in 2024, the Chinese-backed Chiang Kai port opened in Peru, shaving 10 days off the sea journey between Shanghai and South America, and providing an alternate shipping route to the Panama Canal. Evan Ellis thinks Chiang Kai was a strategic move.
What's interesting about Chiang Kai is, for those who are familiar with airline models, what China is basically going to with Chiang Kai is a hub and spoke system. So a couple attributes of Chiang Kai. Number one, it's a really deep water port, and so they can bring in these huge new 24,000 TEU ships, which means that the price per container is a lot shorter. Number two, the geographic distance between the port of Chiang Kai in Peru and Shanghai in China is one of the closest distances across the Pacific. So transit times are shorter. Number three, they are leveraging relatively low costs in Peru and almost complete automation. They've created an enormous patio space by basically burrowing a tunnel under this mountain highway. And so on the other side, they have access to enormous amounts of space to put new containers. Costco, the Chinese company, has exclusive control operating this port, so they can basically keep the other shipping companies out. What that means is not only the direct service between Peru and Asia, but everybody else who wants a piece of that Trans-Pacific shipping, instead of using one of those mid-sized ships in long routes, you know, you basically use a feeder route that goes into Chiang Kai, Iquique, Chile. The Costco is essentially locking up the value added and dominating the other shipping alliances for Trans-Pacific shipping.
Sometimes this is portrayed as a Chinese idea, you know, to take over a key port in Peru. In fact, it is the other way around. Chiang Kai, the land there, was owned by a private company, Peruvian company. They were keen to develop it as a port. So they went to the United States and tried to raise capital for it and entice U.S. companies to build it. There were no takers. They went to Europe. Same story. They went to China. And, well, there, Costco, which is one of the biggest port building companies in the world, Costco said yes. And is right now, it's the most advanced port on the west coast of South America. So there's a message there.
I'm sure that governments in Peru and elsewhere would like to have a choice. But right now, the Chinese proposition, and I say, let's be honest, part of it is to do with state subsidy of the costs. It's not necessarily under market conditions. But if you're the Peruvian government, maybe you don't care about that much at the moment. You want to get the stuff out the door, on the ground, and working and growing your economy. Particularly since, unlike China, Peru does have elections, and the president is going to have to go back to his voters in 3-4 years' time and say, when they say, well, what do you do for us in the last 3 or 4 years? Saying, well, I got the Chinese to bring in a massive great deal, created jobs, created growth, vote for me. That's a better selling proposition than, well, the Americans might come back in 10 years' time and do something for us then.
Professor Wang Wen says the Chinese have simply filled a vacuum in the market.
In the past 2 decades, more and more Latin American countries, they are disappointed with the West, especially the United States. So that's why I think it's not so-called threat. It's a marketization competition, right? So we didn't colonize Latin America. We didn't send our military soldier to Latin America. We just provide our public goods. And this public goods has no political elements or no any political, pressure.
But politics, pressure, and China's motives are hotly debated. What does it want to do? Rana Mitter.
What I think it does want to do is to make sure that long-term influence in South America and the rest of the world is tied to China's economic presence, and that is a political factor to put forward. Question of whether that's a threat to the US. Well, if the US considers this to be a threat to its interests, then the remedy lies actually in Western hands. South Americans, one suspects, would love to have competition to the big Chinese 5G providers, to the green tech energy providers. These are things, these are public goods that South America wants. At the moment, China has proved the cheapest places and also fast and efficient installation to say, well, in that case, we're going to go in that direction towards China.
Latin American business with China is skyrocketing, and so is trade. Brazilian soybeans are sailing west, and electronics east across the Pacific. It was around 2016 that US Republicans started getting twitchy.
Concern kind of bubbled up, and the defining moment of change, I would say, was 2017 with the new national security strategy of the first Trump administration, which really explicitly said China is not just a competitor, China is basically an adversary, and we need to push back against it. And I think some of that pushback was clumsy, but the reason I mentioned that trajectory was that although there was increasing nervousness, it really wasn't until the first Trump administration, I think, that you had a policy consensus that, you know, it wasn't a matter just to worry, but to actively push back in the interest of U.S. strategic equities against China and Latin America.
The hold that China has on technology in so much of the infrastructure of South America is going to be a very hard area of influence for America to overturn. Once you set up a 5G network, you're not going to suddenly rip it all out and put in a new one because Washington doesn't like it. Once you've installed lots of green tech, well, that's not going to suddenly be reversed because the US has taken a pro-fossil fuel policy. So in all those areas, China has leverage, has cards to play. And the fact that it's able to play them in the long term makes it much harder for the US to get on the front foot and reverse that position.
China's struggle against the United States will continue, will persist for a long time, because China hopes to use development and cooperation as a weapon. We use development and cooperation as weapons to build non-confrontation influence and make a contribution to making the world a better place. Latin American countries, they will prefer to cooperate with China more. This is my prediction.
Cooperation is also sweetened by Chinese funds. But is it a debt trap, as many say?
The Chinese are very good at creating these elaborate contractual relationships, even with unreliable partners, to make sure that they get paid. And so they actually started doing this in Africa with Angola and Mozambique with the oil, where they said, okay, our company will come in and pump the oil. We'll basically give you a line of credit if you want to do projects or import goods from our companies. And the money will never leave China because essentially you'll get our stuff and in our work on credit, and then it'll be repaid with our oil that we're extracting. And they applied that to Venezuela. But all of those things basically ran up the line of credit in a bank account in China. And again, Chinese products, Chinese work. In parallel, there was an agreement between China National Petroleum Corporation and the Venezuelan national oil company, PDVSA, to pump a certain amount of oil and deliver that oil to the petroleum ports. Now, the Chinese got the money for that oil and not the Venezuelan oil company. And so if you just basically kept the payments coming from the oil, that line of credit would pay itself off very, very quickly. The actions that the U.S. has taken against the Shadow Fleet tankers, technically, that is oil that was going to China, and China has taken the hit. It's not about getting the oil, but the oil is what shows you're winning. What happens next, maybe with Cuba, where China has some stakes? What happens with Nicaragua and elsewhere?
Some people say that Cuba might be next. Is the U.S. plan to expel China from Latin America realistic? I don't think it is, because those links are now embedded, and you cannot wish them away, which is why I say that this great power competition between Washington and Beijing is playing out in Latin America in a way that had not been the case in the past.
The head of state may have been changed in Venezuela in the blink of an eye by the United States, but the underlying provision of 5G, communications, a lot of the things that will matter for decades to come in Venezuela, still being provided by China. And that story of influence is, I think, one that even 50 years ago in the 1970s, very few people would have been able to predict. And yet it's a literal reality in the world of the 2020s. If the United States wants to really push hard on the idea that Chinese presence of any sort in the area is impermissible, then it will need to turn its mind to how it replaces the economic and infrastructural role that China plays in the region. So far, you know, it's early days, but so far I haven't yet heard a story about how that's supposed to happen. If the cloud computing isn't Huawei, then which American actor is going to provide that cloud computing and at what price, and how will it be paid for? If it's not Chinese electric vehicles, well, okay, is it going to be American ones? Who's making them? At what price? Again, so far, these are questions that are only barely being asked and are certainly not, I think, meaningfully being answered.
The United States is not signing free trade agreements anymore. It is not offering market access. It is not offering international cooperation of any kind. As you know, USAID was closed down. So basically, US policy is all sticks and no carrots.
Let me tell you, in all cases, they all want to make deals. But now it's our turn to do the ripping.
Every day we hear from the American government, President Trump's announcement every day, because every day very, very loudly. And I think it's very obvious under the President Trump's administration, U.S. will curb China's interest expansion in Latin America through economic suppression, isolate China diplomatically and through public opinion. If the United States does this, then China will definitely retaliate. For example, China will strengthen economic integration between China and Latin America and reduce Latin American country dependence on U.S. dollar system.
De-dollarization may lead at least some South American countries, particularly the more left-leaning ones, to head towards more usage of the Chinese renminbi as an alternative currency, particularly for bilateral deals. In economic terms, you can see that certainly at least for a couple of decades, China is going to be more and more visible in South American life. Electric vehicles will be Chinese. The green energy provision will be Chinese. So I think the visibility of China in South America, which was close to invisible 70 or 80 years ago, I think is now unmistakable and will continue to be a very important part of geoeconomics, which of course is in some senses these days geopolitics by another name.
Well, frankly, right now, I think we are heading towards a pretty big clash, you know, with our new national security strategy. You know, President Trump has made it very clear that we are going to push back against Chinese influence, including possibly through the use of military instruments as well as commercial ones, and especially areas that are, you know, strategic choke points like Panama and certain sensitive domains like the digital domain and perhaps space. On the other hand, China, with its white paper, has said, we're going full speed ahead. And so it seems like we're heading towards a bit of a problem right now. My sense is at the end of the day, the only way to really have a peaceful coexistence is if there are clear rules of the game, finding a common set of rules where everyone can engage in Latin America. I think we're moving exactly in the opposite direction right now, but at the end of the day, it's either going to end up there or it's going to end up in war. And you know, we certainly all hope not for the latter.
So in my opinion, the real crisis for United States is not China's presence in Latin America. It lies in the collapse of United States' external image. I think the ultimate outcome will be the bankrupt of the credibility of United States itself. United States should rethink themselves. Why? Why they lost Latin America?
Professor Wang Wen, Dean at Chongyang Institute at Renmin University in Beijing, ending today's program. You also heard Evan Ellis, Professor of American Studies with the US Army War College, Rana Mitter, ST Lee Chair in US-Asia Relations at the Harvard Kennedy School, and Jorge Heine, former Chilean Ambassador to China and non-resident fellow at the Quincy Institute in Washington, D.C. I'm Rose Blewett, and you've been listening to Rear Vision. Thanks for your company.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.